Content warnings for this episode include discussions about religious trauma and the horrors of life. Additionally, one of the stories talks about childhood sexual assault.
Listening to Horror Nerds at Church, a ridiculously queer podcast where we take a deep dive into a horror film or a book and talk about how it connects to queerness, religion, and theology. I'm Pastor Emily, and I am the pillow rocks lulling children into sleepy deaths.
I like it. My name is Pace, and I am the beginning of the spooky season, since we're getting so close to October. I'm so excited for Halloween.
It's true.
And any of you?
Well, my name is Lee Murray. Thank you for having me back on Horror Nerds at Church. It's wonderful to be back here. And I am a writer, editor, poet, screenwriter, essayist from Aotearoa, New Zealand, and the editor of Remains to be Told, Dark Tales of Aotearoa, which we'll be talking about today. And I am mostly passionate about writing and cheese. Cheese is my other passion. I just thought I'd put that out there. Ooh,
I love it.
I love cheese.
I'm Kirsten McKenzie from Aotearoa, New Zealand as well. I am a full-time writer. I split my time between time travel and paranormal horror. This is my first time in church in a very, very long time, so thank you for having me in your church. I once came 13th in the Make My Horror Movie contest that Ant Timpson ran in New Zealand. So that's my claim to fame, and that was the genesis of my first horror. So coming 13th was a sign. Nice.
That's awesome.
Well, I'm Jackie Greaves, and I'm also from Aotearoa, New Zealand. I mostly write science fiction and fantasy, but it tends to darkness, and this is really my first conscious effort at horror. So, and I'm really excited to be here. This is my very, very, very first podcast, so I'm thrilled. I even had to go and buy a headset. Yay.
Cool, lucky last. So I am Nikki Lee. I am also a speculative fiction, basically everything, from Aotearoa, New Zealand. However, I am also the token Aussie. I've sort of snuck in here. Awesome. I've been here since about 2016, so I've been adopted. So I'm like the little black sheep of the family.
Thank you all for being here. For our listeners at home, we are going to be talking about this awesome upcoming volume, Remains to be Told. But before we get into that, just want to say follow us on Patreon at patreon.com/horrornerdsatchurch for the video of today's episode. It's only $5 to sign up, and you get exclusive access to hours of bonus content, including BooTube episodes about TV shows, movie commentaries, bonus episodes, and more.
For this, our book mini season, you do not have to have read the books to follow along. We won't reveal any major spoilers without some warning. But instead, this is a chance to listen for some flavor of the book, some of the lore in them, and what kind of treasures await if you pick up the book yourself from your local bookshop or get your library to order it for you.
For sure. And we will put the pre-order link in the bio of the show. So make sure to click on that and get your own copy. I'm super excited for it. And then just one announcement I have, and then we'll get right into the book, is one of the reasons we're doing this book mini season is because of the SAG-AFTRA and WGA strikes and the importance of, so that's part of it why we delayed our season talking about movies. But this is also something we've really been wanting to do for a long time, is to do some episodes on books, so we couldn't be happier to do this. This is really cool. So we're covering some horror books, some Star Wars books in preparation for our forthcoming season 6 on Star Wars and Alien franchises. So this is really fun.
Yeah, this is exciting. I'm excited about it. We've talked about a book club, so this is like a teaser for folks. And then if they want to join our Patreon, they can join our Patreon at the book club level, and we'll do book clubs and do more of like this.
For sure.
So today, as mentioned, we are talking about Remains to be Told. Remains to be Told, Dark Tales of Aotearoa, edited by Lee Murray. And featuring uncanny disturbances, death, and the dank breath of the native bush. Remains to be Told, Dark Tales of Aotearoa. Dark Tales of Aotearoa is mired in the shifting landscape of the long white cloud and deeply imbued with the myth, culture, and character of Aotearoa, New Zealand. Laced with intrigue, suspense, horror, and even a touch of humor, Remains to be Told brings together stories and poems by some of the best homegrown and Kiwi at heart voices working in dark fiction today. And this is curated by multi-award winning author, editor Lee Murray, with a foreword by 6-time Bram Stoker Awards winner and former HWA president Lisa Morton, and stories and poems by Dan Roberts, Kirsten McKenzie, Celine Murray, Catherine Burnett, Helena Claudia, Marty Young, Gina Cole, William Cook, Del Gibson, Paul Mannering, Tim Jones, Owen Marshall, Denver Grinnell, Bryce Stevens, Neil Gaiman, Debbie Cohens, Lee Murray, Jackie Greaves, Tracy McBride, and Nikki Lee. Did I pronounce those right?
Yes, you did fantastically well. I was super impressed. I'm so pleased you doing it and not me.
I was reading the stories and I was like, there are words here that are not like in all of the languages I know. I don't know how to pronounce these words. And I was like, I'm not going to mess up people's names. So I'm glad that I did that well.
And I gave Emily the hard task this time. Thank you, Emily. So one of the things that is kind of becoming our trademark on Horror Nerds at Church is we talk about horror and its crossover with religion, of course, but we also talk sometimes about the horrors of religion. Emily and I are both queer people. Emily is still active as a pastor in the ELCA, which is a Lutheran organization, and I am not particularly religious, but both of us are queer people, so there's a lot of harm that happens with queer people in certain branches of Christianity, especially. So we kind of look at all those kind of things together. And so a question that we ask all of our guests who come on the show is, if you have a real life church horror story, it can be something supernatural. We've had people talk about hauntings that they've experienced in church buildings, or people who've talked about exorcisms. We've had some wild and horrific stories on here, but then we also have some funny stories, and sometimes we have stories where people just are like, this shitty thing happened to me in a church, and I was like picked on for being queer, or those kind of stories. So whatever fits for the story, you don't have to answer, but if you have one, we'd love to hear it.
I have one.
Who's being brave?
My hand up. It was more horrifying for my godmother when I moved to England when I was 21, and I hadn't seen my godmother since I was 8. And she thought she was doing the right thing. She had been traveling, so she hadn't been to her church, her Baptist church, for a while. We turn up to church, and they'd had an American pastor, and they'd turned quite, I'm not quite sure even what the right word is, which is strange for me, but people started running up and down the aisles, waving these giant orange flags, and people were talking in tongues. And my poor godmother was beyond mortified that she had taken me to this fundamentalist, bizarre experience.
Pentecostal.
Yes, thank you, that's the word. Yeah. And she never went back, and I certainly went back. And that was my only time of going to church with my God. The poor woman, I think, is, you know, she's still traumatized to this day, you know, 20 years later.
Yeah. I mean, if you are not used to it and you are not expecting it at all, which many people would not, that is horrifying. Like, it is it is terrifying to all of a sudden see people speaking in tongues and that sort of thing.
Speaking in tongues just lends itself to a horror novel or a horror short story just by dint of existence.
Right.
Yeah. I feel like there could be a whole, maybe that's the next anthology, is just like the different traces of religious horror somewhere.
Yep.
I've just remembered my dad was a fundamental Christian, and the first time I ever took a girlfriend home, he called me devil spawn, which amused me intensely because, I mean, whose spawn was it? So.
Love it. I didn't even think about it that way. That is brilliant.
No. Oh, I love it.
Okay, you do know that New Zealand is colloquially called God Zone, and you know, my dad always says it's because the country is the way it is. It's just so beautiful that we have. It's a local call to God from here, so to paradise effectively.
Where I grew up.
Really? Okay. So
in
maybe
the
that's a universal
Colorado,
thing.
But.
Right. Yeah. Well, certainly there is that would explain it, because the countryside is beautiful there too. I have to say that you know, I have, New Zealand's quite secular. I haven't been active at church since I was a child, but I have written one poem, just a poem set in a church, and that was inspired by the time I spent living in France, and there's so much just absolutely glorious Gothic architecture over there, and you know, the Notre Dame with its gargoyles, and so I wrote a gargoyle story for Frank Kaufman's anthology, The Gargoylicon, and it's a sonnet about a gargoyle who is actually, it's a Beauty and the Beast retelling where the gargoyle is a prince who's been transformed into a gargoyle because he didn't want to marry some woman he considered ugly, and a woman who's accused of being a witch runs into the church for sanctuary, and to be released from his spell, he needs her to kiss him, and of course she's lovely and she does, and because he says there's a way out, and the way out is she turns into stone and is stuck there instead. So there we go. That was my that's my little sonnet. Yeah. So you can read that sonnet in The Gargoylicon by Frank Kaufman.
That is scandalous. He did not learn any good lessons from that experience. That's awesome.
I think for me, I haven't actually, like, I haven't been to a church in a very long time, but I was thinking, I've only written really something maybe once about it, but then I was thinking, actually, no, I've written about it twice. The first one is like a comedy comedy short story about a gargoyle that gets fired from his church. that was one of the first stories I ever had published, so like probably 12, 13 years ago now. And that was just a short little thing. And then the other one was for Midnight
Echo, such a good story too. So good.
Again, called The Dead May Dance, and that was featuring a necromancer who is basically taking revenge against a fictional church leader who essentially abused his power. So it was a little bit of a commentary on people who should be pillars of the community but are not. And its finale is set in a church. Sure. I don't want to sort of go too much into it, because otherwise it will spoil the story.
And I've got one short story, The Abyss, in my recent collection, Letters from Elsewhere. And the young woman has been abused by her priest or pastor in this case. And it explores how she becomes monstrous. The whole book is about becoming monstrous, so it's and you know how she gets her revenge on him in her process to becoming a monster.
I feel like there's a lot of times where in Disney it happens all the time, right, where the villain is queer coded, and so like the queer kids then relate to the villain, and I feel like that kind of in that space, Jackie, of like, I mean, she's probably, I'm assuming, the protagonist, but there's this like, as she becomes a monster, but then to hear the actual story and what happened to get to that point is she still remains the protagonist because the real monster is the one who causes her.
Yes. Yeah. It's kind of trying to twist who is the actual monster and make us question what is it to be monstrous and who's the worst monster.
Yeah, it's a very strong metaphor. And I think that it works really well for all marginalized groups, actually. I think if you consider Asian horror, which is an area that I've been working in a lot, almost all Asian monsters are female. And I think that's really interesting. Yeah, almost all of them. And, you know, why are they female? And my colleague, Christina Singh, who is a Bram Stoker Award-winning poet three times over, I think, and she says, well, because women have just cause. And I thought that was just the, you know, the perfect solution for that. I think Jackie's right. It's a really excellent metaphor, that whole monster is... you know, it's the other, really.
And that leads so well into like so many of your stories that we read for that are in this book, but also that that space of like, who is the monster? Who is the evil one? Why is this person doing these things? And is it actually evil, or are they set up to be viewed as the evil one?
Yeah,
it's a really interesting thing about New Zealand horror. And, you know, this is one of very few New Zealand horror volumes out there. In fact, I think there's only one other anthology of uniquely New Zealand horror on the market at the moment. And so I'm really excited about it. But I think one of the things that's core and central to New Zealand horror is that sense of the uncanny, the spiritual, sort of that very thin veil between realms, and both Maori and our Indigenous people and also our Pākehā peoples believe that there is this uncanny threat, the spiritualism, this lonely sort of savageness to our land and to just the nature of the place, which is monstrous and lends itself to the monstrous and is the source of, if you like, of our horror. And I think that thread is very clear in this anthology. And while there isn't so much, you know, viscera and gore that you might see in some other more traditional anthologies, it is that pervasive sense of otherness, of loneliness, of isolation, that really that tension that just is overriding and overwhelming in this country, and that we all feel. I'm sure my contributors here will say the same. And I think that is that monstrous that we're talking about when we talk about New Zealand horror.
I don't believe in God, but there's a very famous painting of a waka, a Maori canoe on Lake Tarawera. And there's a famous, a very well-known Maori myth about this ghost waka appeared before the eruption of Mount Tarawera, and it's been recorded in this painting. Now that I believe in. I believe wholeheartedly that this ghostly waka appeared on Lake Tarawera to warn of the eruption of Mount Tarawera. And whenever I go to the Auckland Art Gallery and I see that painting, it brings shivers to my soul. But I don't go into a church and believe that there is one true God.
Yeah.
So the New Zealand landscape,
yes,
and the connection of the Maori people to that landscape. I don't have any Maori descent in me. My mother and my father are both first. They moved here as children, so I'm first generation New Zealander. But I feel that every time I travel into the countryside or travel up country, down country to any of the islands, whenever I look out at Rangitoto, Meta Harbour, I don't know what it is about New Zealand, but it just is. It just lends itself to those haunting visions and feelings that attach you to the land.
Well, I wonder if it's something to do, Kirsten, with the fact that, you know, our Maori pepaha, you know, how people introduce themselves here in New Zealand, they talk about the mountain that nurtures them, the river that is their local river, that when people introduce themselves here, they give what is an introduction to their tribe, their place, their central the place that they stand, and that always involves a natural feature, so a river, a lake, a mountain, and the sense of that sense that those things nurture us, that they're considered ancestors here in New Zealand, and that is not just for the Maori people. That has been codified into law here in New Zealand. So, for example, the Yurrawerra Forest, which is this beautiful piece of forest not far from where Jackie and I live, has personhood. It's a person in its own right, and in order to protect it. So we have a river here, the Taranaki, the mountain in Taranaki is a person in its own right. So that, because it is an ancestor and it is revered as such. And so when you think about it like that, the whole land is full of spirits, because every geographical feature has some personhood or some spirit, some connection to the past anchored in it. So I think that might be part of it, don't you think?
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. It's just such a powerful idea when you think about it, when you think that, you know, it's probably the first country to codify some of that stuff into our legal system. So it's quite powerful.
And it comes through in your story, like the stories that you all wrote. I mean, I can't speak to other stories you've written, but for this anthology, the land and the place definitely are characters. Like, they are their own character. They do their own things. They take action. They have, like, there's a way that it is embodied, because we only have, like, human-centric language to talk about it, but, like, embodied the feelings and the emotions and the characteristics of the place. Beautiful.
Yeah. I think this is a good time to perhaps go through each of the stories, and we'll do it in the order, but just I'd love to hear the order they appear in the volume, I should say. But I'd love to hear basically what was the origin of the story and anything you just want to say about the story itself. And we can talk a little bit about each story. So the first is Fires of Fate. If you can say something about that, Jackie.
I've always been intrigued by mythology. I had, as a young girl, I had this book of myths, which was, you know, Egyptian and Greek and Roman, all those sort of, you know, traditional classic myths. And as I got older, that realization that myths are so common, and the links and the similarities between them are really clear. And so that whole fire story, you know, Prometheus giving humans the fire, Maui, who's a trickster god in New Zealand, like Prometheus was a trickster, gave humans fire. And I really like those parallels and those links. And I had kind of Greek mythology on my mind because of another short story I'd written. And so the Greek mythology came into this story, and then the Maori mythology came in, and then I threw in this character Brownie, who for me is just a hapless all man. He's such a you know, he thinks he's brave, he thinks he's clever, and he's just not. But he's so many men that I know. You know, I've taken all of these men and just bundled them into this Brownie character, and how he kind of tries to weave his way through and make sense of this kind of growing tragedy. It is a tragedy. It's a tragic story, but it's and weaving his way through these gods who are just messing with him terribly, and there's again the links with Prometheus, with the birds and Brownie and the birds. So that was kind of what I toyed and messed with, and
I love the way
Fires of Fate,
like sometimes we do one sentence summaries of stuff, and so my like one sentence distillation of the story is like, don't be a shitty sexist. Right, but there's so much. Has the chance. He like intuitively knows the appropriate response to her is to shit himself, and instead he's like, "Oh, but I got buddies, so I'm going to be a sexist asshole." And then like after that, there is this fire that is both like cleansing in that it cleanses the land of these people who are starting fires, but also it's harmful, right? Like, it's the ways that,
yeah,
particularly like, yeah, colonialism and colonization start fires and destroy,
yeah,
land and the natural plant life and ecosystems to then do whatever they want with it. So you get like, yeah, both of those from fire.
Yeah. And in New Zealand at that time, they were just burning. Mm. And Apiti is a place I lived in. I've lived there and I've farmed there. And so I know that landscape intimately. And you know, the smoke hung in the air for months. And that was one of the last little pockets of the North Island to be cleared by fire. And it's just sad, you know, that all that beautiful virgin forest just got destroyed. Mm. And so kind of there was a sense of sadness in writing it that's how that place that I love, but which lends itself so beautifully to horror, came to be that little farming community that it is now.
Yeah, I love look, I'm just going to say here that Kirsten and Nikki are at a disadvantage. In fact, all of my contributors are just at a disadvantage because they haven't read the book yet. They only know their own stories, and they go, oh, you know, is that what Jackie's story's about? Oh, and so I really must send them an e-book soon. But I love the way that Jackie pulled in these historical aspects as well as the supernatural. And especially the fact that New Zealand was the first country to gain suffrage. So she really empowered the women straight away from the outset of her story. But also, I love that whole descent into madness kind of, that's the events that cause people to think differently. And I thought that was really cleverly done. So a really nice way to sort of dovetail different mythologies and bring them together. I thought that was fantastic.
Yeah.
I liked it. And I really love the artwork that Emma Weekly's done for Jackie's Toe. It's absolutely gorgeous. It includes our native birds on hers. So it's really stunning. Awesome. So yeah.
Yeah, I am not a horror. We joke, our next season is a Star Wars season, right? So we joke that Pace is the horror master and I am the horror Padawan, which is, yep, accurate in film and in books. I definitely dive into young adult dystopias, and so it has lent itself well to reading these stories. But I was just blown away by the stories. I think short stories work because then it doesn't get as, like, I don't get as sucked in and have nightmare, which is really why I'd, like, have to be measured in my horror stuff. But these stories, as I was reading them, are just, like, it's hilarious to me, Lee, that nobody's read each other's stories, because there was, like, a thing in Nikki's about, like, a teddy bear that I was like, wait, is this the teddy bear? And I was like, it probably is not. None of the other stories that I've read for this are like connected and stuff. But I was like, but especially because Kirsten's, yours was like the first one that I read for it. And then Nikki's is the last story in the anthology. And so it's like,
yeah.
Right. And so it's just like a funny, completely unintentional connecting thread, which brings us back to Nikki Lee's book, Kirsten's. Sorry. We got a little switched up in our order. So we're going to the first story in the anthology of the four of your stories, to The Watchman by Kirsten McKenzie, which I'm curious about the origin of the story because I was fascinated, as a younger child, I was fascinated by this story.
So The Watchman is actually the name of a painting whose artist name escapes me, but it was just a man in shadows just looking, staring out. And we have an annual fair, carnival, that show here, the Easter show. And my children are older now, they're teenagers, but I took my oldest daughter this year. No friends. She had nothing to do. Nobody loves her. Anyway, so my husband and I and my oldest teen went to the Easter show, and a tiny bit of backstory about me is I used to be a customs officer, and I used to investigate importers of objectionable materials. So I've seen more porn than anybody I've ever met, and all of it is objectionable. So I have a viewpoint when I look at strangers that is on the "you are a bad man" spectrum. So I'm an overprotective.
What are you doing that you shouldn't be?
Yeah, why are you at the Easter show? What are you doing? Where is the child that you've brought with you? Why are you looking at my teenage daughter? So I have this viewpoint that I apologize, Pace, that a lot of men are bad men, and I jumped to that conclusion, and no counsel has ever changed that opinion. Anyway, so
I mean, the good news is Pace is non-binary,
retract my statement, Pace. Thank you. And
it's all good. Yep.
So I'm at the Easter show. There are those crazy, crusty old men who run the rides with their dirty fingernails and their unshaven faces and their filthy, grease-soaked jeans and with a cigarette hanging out of the corner of their mouth, and they're just scary.
I love how everyone's nodding, so we all know exactly what
she's such a good writer, isn't she? She just evokes it straight away with
there's the smell of vomit, and there's the smell of popcorn, and there's a smell of popcorn.
Got it.
But my other daughter, my younger daughter, was there with a group of friends, and we were trying to meet up, and she had become separated from her friends, and that feeling of where's my 14-year-old daughter? There are crowds and crowds of people. It's hot. There's crusty pedophiles filling the aisles of the Easter show. Anyway, and we had just had the floods in Auckland. So Auckland suffered from some horrific floods in January, which wiped out the West Coast. And the other part of me is I love tramping. Now, tramping is hiking. So for your listeners, tramping is not... is not...
Thank you. I was like, there were a few terms that I was like...
So I love hiking.
A lot of trampers in New Zealand.
So I love hiking, and I love hiking in the New Zealand bush, and I've done all the great walks. And the West Coast is a great place to go hiking, which you can't do at the moment because all the tracks have been wiped out. Anyway, so the weather, the tramps, the fair. So I just lifted up the Easter show, dumped it down on the West Coast of New Zealand, which is a secluded place, even more secluded now with all the roads that have been washed out. And then I moved it back to the late 1950s, early 1960s. So then I didn't have to contend with CCTV, because CCTV is the bane of my life as a writer. Because, you know, and cell phones and tracking and...
That explains everything.
Everything's scarier when you don't have technology to fall back on to help you solve a crime. So that's my crime... So I've got two daughters, and I'm an eldest daughter. So for those people who have read The Watchmen, you'll know that being the eldest child and having a younger sibling, it creates all sorts of friction between you and your younger sibling, your parents, and whose responsibility is it to look after that younger sister or younger brother? And what happens if you just want to look after yourself? You want to be selfish, but you're the eldest child, so you're not allowed to be selfish because you're taught that you have to look after.
Right.
And they I didn't always get the first and the best, but like, I definitely got away with stuff that my older sibling did not.
Yeah, 100%. And I try to be fair to my daughters. And one or the other will always say, you love the other one more. It's so unfair. It's so unfair. So that's the friction in the story about the oldest child wants to be selfish, but and the teddy bear and I don't even know if I've answered the question. I've gone so far off tangent, sorry. Pedophiles and fairs and
that's great. I love it. This is exactly right.
And now I'm seeing the teddy bear the teddy bear connection, but also interestingly, Nikki and Kirsten are both inspired by Cyclone Gabriel that happened earlier in the year. So not only do they share though that Easter egg of the teddy bear, but there's also that inspiration that came from the flooding earlier in the year. Yeah. So nice thinking.
Yeah.
That's all right.
The only one that has no idea about the teddy.
I'm sorry. I'm going to have to send you girls this book. My goodness, I'm behind the eight ball.
Well, and I loved it because I do root for the older child when there's like a situation where the younger child is clearly there's favoritism. And so I was like, definitely Team Cindy the whole time I was reading the story. And I was like, yeah, you should get to win yourself the teddy bear and keep it. Yeah. Of course. That happens like fairly early on in the story. It's a carnival, right? Like, so, yeah. But, yeah. Go for it.
That the fringes of a carnival, you know, in the middle of a carnival, it's all boisterous and noisy and there's lots of activity. But on the fringes of the carnival, it's actually a really horrible place. It's, you know, it's the back behind the amusement rides and there's litter and there's wires. And it's just, there's something very sinister about the margins of a carnival, you know. There's all this energy and creating fun, and then on the outskirts it's just something very sinister and lonely, and yeah, and Kirsten really leaned into that really beautifully. I love the story. And you know, as soon as you step over those hay bales, which are the outskirts of the carnival, you are in a different place, and I thought she handled it so well. It's such a great story. I can't wait for people to read it.
Yeah, I was reminded of Chicago. I went to seminary in Chicago, graduate school. And one of the things that happened in the Chicago World's Fair is that there was a serial killer during the Chicago World's Fair, which is like, right, it's the carnival, but like times 10 or whatever, right? And so like that piece of each person, especially like this carny worker, being suspicious, and like the space of a carnival being this ideal place for people to disappear, for like a serial killer would have a feast at a carnival. Yeah. And that particular piece, it was just fascinating to me.
Thanks, Emily.
Yeah, I loved it. And I just also loved the, like, I had just been to the Minnesota State Fair about a week before reading the story for the first time. So I'm like, I am right there. And you have such a great way with like being visual with it that you really feel like you're part of there. And it's really taking me back to the creepiness, but also the fun of Minnesota State Fair. I think the next story is Dead End Town by Lee Murray, who also edited this book. So I'd love to hear about both, if you want to talk a little bit about the book as a whole, but your story for sure.
Yeah. The book as a whole, I'm just super proud of. I'm super proud to be involved with the contributors. That I could have filled this book 10 times over, to be honest. There's so much talent down here. And it's just, it's kind of high time, isn't it, girls? You know, like it's high time that there has been there is a volume, a sampler volume, so people can discover our writers. So, you know, I was really thrilled to be able, we got a little grant to and Clandestine Press came on board, and they've invested, you know, in the work with the artwork and what have you, and really excited. And the stories I got, there's just such, I mean, you'll know, Pace and Emily, there's such a breadth, but there is still an underlying connectivity to all these stories. So I am really, really privileged. My own story is a reprint, actually, which the publisher requested. It was nominated for a Bram Stoker Award a few years back. And it was written in the Me Too movement period. And, you know, I was writing about a teen who's being systematically abused by her mother's boyfriend. And just the trap that is, you know, that if you speak out, you don't win. And if you don't speak out, you don't win. There's no winning if you are not the person of power. So, and I sort of leaned into that isolation, that small town dead-endedness, and that lack of, you know, those communities are very tight-knit. And if you're in the inner, that's great. And if you're not, You know that that's you know you're really not, and so she finds solace, you know, in the landscape because it is such a beautiful place, New Zealand, but it also there are some tricky little fairies called Patupairehi that live in our forests, and that can lead you to other things. And also I wanted to sort of lean into that idea of sort of unknown parentage, which is quite common in Lovecraftian stories. So I love the story. I just loved going there. And it was hard to write, but it was, yeah, it really spoke to me at the time because I was watching things play out on the world stage around you know coming out and being vocal about the patriarchy and the kinds of abuses that happen to women and girls and any marginalized group really. But the whole idea of can you speak out and why don't they say something? Why don't they do something? You know, why don't they just leave, you know, and you just can't. And so I wanted to address that issue. So so that's my story. Oh, and here's the artwork. Let's see if you can see it. Ooh. There's a little bit of artwork by Emma Weekly, which is just the bus stop where a character an event happens in the story. So.
But it does give like this sense of it is a dead, like almost ghost towny. Like the simplicity of that artwork, that's beautiful. When I started reading your story, Lee, I was like, okay, this is we're already in the horror story. How does this even go? Like, how do you, because so often it's like everything is kind of idyllic and everything seems fine and then it gets horrific. And this, I was like, literally the first line is horrific. And so yeah. I was like, I also was a little bit confused by the uncle part when mom came back and was like in a relationship with uncle, and I was like, and then I like got the context clues and was like, okay, that's just like in the US a lot of times it's just like stepdad, or we just use like the name of the person, so we don't like uncle is a different kind of thing. And so I was like,
yeah,
oh, okay, that makes more sense.
New Zealanders do that, don't we? We call someone auntie or uncle if they're close to the family. And so it's kind of a trick for young players, isn't it? Because that's just a very local thing that we tend to do. We call people.
Oh really?
Yeah, it's very Kiwi.
Don't even have
it
in Aussie. It was something that I noticed.
And it makes sense.
Oh, really?
And there are girls that in the US that do use aunt and uncle or auntie and uncle. I just was like, I was set in from the start, like, this is my mother's brother. And then I was like, oh no, it's not. That would be like,
yeah, well, that happens too.
Well, I really hope
does
it's
it
not.
Not. I mean,
yeah. Like, and that's why I was like, it didn't even faze me that this would be my, like, of course. And then I was like, oh, okay. But there's just like so much that is packed into that of that isolation that resonates not just with like a New Zealand context. There's different aspects of all of this that are like so uniquely New Zealand. But that particular place of like being in a town that just won't be there for you the way that you
won't
need
see
to
you.
Kid.
Yeah, yeah, that don't doesn't yeah. see you. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was all of these stories were great, but it was just like
New Zealand's filled with these tiny towns. This tiny every time you drive from one main center to the next main center, you'll drive through a dozen tiny towns that are slowly decaying and dying, but there's still a population there, but it's a dying, decaying population.
Yeah. And how like unsafe and isolating that can feel, especially like the character in your story, like many women and girls experience, and as you said, many just marginalized folk, queer folk, neurodivergent folk, like I just that resonates so much with me, and also and was just so well written and
thank you
impactful, so thank you for that story. It's great. And That also, just to shout out someone who's been on our podcast before, Ben Monroe, his novel, The Seething, kind of also has that small town aspect to it. That's really creepy. So that was another.
Oh, his and his has the corn as well. You know, yes. It's one of the, you know, and the lakes that so there are some similarities there with the New Zealand, you know, with lakes and little islands on them and townships nestled in sort of out of the way places. I did love that book. It was a fantastic first novel. He did really well with it.
I think that brings us to the final teddy bear.
I didn't realize the teddy bear was going to be such a thing that everyone pays attention to.
Right? So, What Bones These Tides Bring by Nikki Lee. Fascinating, not only because I decided that the teddy bears were connected, but also this, like, sense of souls as power and like, power source. And, yeah. So, what's the origin of the... How did this story come to be? That's the question.
It's one of those really odd ones because it was 100% pantsed. So when I say pantsed, it was written by the seat of my pants. So I was literally putting one sentence after the other and going, this is interesting. Let's follow that and see what happens. And I guess the only thing that was really set in my mind going in was that I wanted it to start on the black sand beaches of New Zealand's west coast, because that to me is quintessentially New Zealand, especially coming from Perth in Western Australia, where we have these white, just crisp white sand beaches. That's the only kind of beach you ever see. And so going from like one west coast to another west coast is completely different. And it was one of the first things I ever saw when I moved here. Was my boyfriend, now husband, took me down and drove me all along that coast. And it's just super rugged, really sort of intense. Like, it's loads of rips. It's very dangerous to swim there. The surfers love it. And so it's very rugged. It's got this sort of very eerie, dangerous sort of connotations because it's cliffs and people have gone missing. So that was kind of the starting point. And then it wasn't really until I wrote the lines, essentially, when the ocean is angry, nice. It coughs up the best trinkets, because we've got a beachcomber looking for things on the beach. And then the next line is the best trinkets and then the best bones. And that was then set off everything else. So this lady is essentially like a bone collector, and she collects bones of dead things. And then all kind of just unfolded from there, just followed whatever was the most interesting thread to follow.
Yeah. This one was like so chilling. It was so, yeah, so good. Thank you.
Yeah, I knew Nikki would bring me something special. She always does. And she really knocked it out of the park with this one. And it was the right place to end the anthology. I love that there's this sense of hope even in the darkness of Nikki's story. There's that kernel of hope that, you know, we can make it through despite, even in the worst possible dystopian nightmare, there is a sense of connection there. And I think that idea of family and belonging and sacrifice for something bigger than yourself. And I think that was the right place to, the right note to end the anthology on, despite the darkness of the story. So, I was really excited when Nikki sent it through. I thought, yes, because, you know, the trouble with horror anthologies is, you know, you get these absolutely fabulously dark stories, but actually, you know, you also want those notes throughout your anthology, the palate cleansers, the opportunity for your reader just to sit back and breathe a little bit. And we're lucky with that because, you know, Catherine Burnett and Paul Mannering both brought us quite quirky, funny, you know, sort of leaning into that sort of black humour of New Zealanders a little bit. So I was able to put some light-hearted moments in there. But then when Nikki came with her story, and just the way it's the future as well, it's that future sense of hope that was a really nice note to leave the anthology on. So I was really pleased to get it, you know, because you really never know what you're going to get when you solicit stories from writers, and you always pick the writers that you know are going to deliver. But also just what what will resonate for them, what they'll bring, and how you order them so that you can, so there's a logical or at least emotional journey through the book. And so I hope we've achieved that with the way that the stories are presented. Not everybody does that. Some people just dip in and read, you know, according to their whim. But I always think carefully about how the stories are ordered, so that there's a journey that the reader can follow. So yeah.
I was gonna say I definitely went on a journey with these stories.
Yeah, all of them so good.
Yes.
Well, I think we've kind of gotten into all the questions we had prepared, with the exception of one. But I know I don't want to take up too much of everyone's time, so I think this is a great way to end the podcast with this particular question too, because I think it gets kind of at the heart of all we've been talking about at the same time, which is we at Horror Nerds at Church are, both Emily and I are queer, non-binary, and so we kind of have really see that and read that into the horror and recognize the ways in which horror as a genre is kind of queer in and of itself, and by queer not just talk about sexuality and gender, but also marginalization and also subversion. And so that's kind of how we look at horror, but I'm very curious, how do each of you define horror, and if that maybe impacted your story somewhere, anything like that?
We also say that anything can be horror, which you get at.
That's the other. That's our other tagline.
So, that's also part of it. It's like, what is horror? You know, simple questions.
I guess I've seen a lot of true life horror that will never leave me, and I don't think anything anybody can write will be as bad as what I've seen. So for me, horror is an escape from reality, because life for some is a living horror movie, and that's awful, and I wish it wasn't true. So I love that in horror you can take your revenge on the perpetrators, and that is a real cathartic thing to read, to read somebody's story where they've taken revenge on a fictional person, but you know, there could be kernels of truth there. But how wonderful to be able to take that revenge.
Yeah.
See karma come in full swing.
I'm the same. I like that revenge aspect, and not just horror, but most of my writing has a revenge component to it. And you know, usually about poor men, but you know, they bring it on themselves.
I was gonna say, as we've been doing horror, we do when we have books or when we have movies on, part of how we do it is like reading and then doing what our favorite kill is, and Pace can attest that my favorite kill every single time is the biggest jerk in the entire thing, where I'm like, he was a sexist asshole. And absolutely, he's my favorite kill, and I'm so glad that the villain killed this person or whatever. But, like, that's how I approach horror, is I'm, like, justice horror. Or, like, in...
the catharsis and the escape of it. Also kind of like what you're saying, Jason, too.
Yeah, and I was just like, let's do it.
Nikki, any thoughts?
I guess... For me, horror is, because I still feel like I'm very much new to the genre, even though I've kind of unintentionally, not realizing, have been actually reading and probably writing a lot of horror, just because it crops up in so many shapes and forms and styles. And so I guess it's one of those things, as we were saying before, it kind of defies definition because it's such a flexible genre, and so many writers and creators lean on its elements. To varying degrees. So it's like, where does like one thing stop and horror start, type thing. So like, I have written a lot of dark fantasy, a lot of sci-fi that have used horror elements, and I didn't actually realize quite recently that I was actually a horror writer. So for me, it's an exploration still. but yeah, it's something about kind of looking at the worst elements of humanity in the face and not really shying away from it. I think that's a big part of it. And again, like the catharsis of kind of confronting it and saying, I will not back down from this. I'm not going to shy away from this particular thing that I want to focus on. I think that definitely plays a part. And I think as well, there's like an atmosphere of horror. Like you've got your gothic horrors, which is very atmospheric, if not actually
you can hear the soundtrack while like reading the book.
Lovely sort of stormy. And that is super fascinating for me as well. So there's, like I said, there's so many different ways it can kind of just appear in a story that it's, I'm still exploring it. And I don't think I'm ever possibly going to have a definition because it is just such a powerful genre with so many ways of turning up.
Oh, goodness. Well, you know, this is, I could talk about this for an hour or maybe more. I won a Bram Stoker Award this year for an essay that is called I Don't Read Horror and Other Weird Tales. And basically it is exactly this. Is what is horror? What is horror? Well, it's transgressive. It's subversive. It's inclusive. It is effective. It is all of those things. It is a spectrum, you know. It's individual. It depends on who's reading it, you know, or viewing it. You know, what do we bring to it? What are our fears? It depends on where we are in our lives, where we live, who we are, our culture. It transcends genre, you know. It's like humor and romance and horror, you know, and it's the thing that people hide under the bed. You know, that we don't tell
elsewhere, not blah, 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 blah. And that's just come out. That's a collection of short stories. So it's a mixture of science fiction, fantasy. There's a lot of sex in there, so a lot of fucking. A bit of horror, a bit of everything. It's about monsters or being monstrous. That theme I like to continue. Lee.
Oops, I've got dispatches just out this week from PS Publishing. I have a movie coming out next year, I think, in the new year, called Grafted. I have a prose poetry collection called Fox Spirit on a Distant Cloud coming from the Cuba Press. It won the NZSA Laura Solomon Cuba Press Prize earlier this year. So I think that's it. A few other things, but
that's why I tried to leap in before Lee.
Got the sequel to this one coming out in December. That's the second book in my second time travel trilogy, and I'm 60,000 words into my latest thriller, which is trying very hard to turn itself into a paranormal thriller, which is my preference. So it's at the moment that one of the characters is in her wardrobe, and I've left it for about a month thinking something happens in the wardrobe. But yeah, so that's where my struggle. I'm a bit like you, Nikki, a bit of a pantser. So something's happening in that wardrobe. I just don't know what yet.
That's a little
like, come on, muse, anytime now.
I don't call it pantsing, but that also works.
For me, so I've just finished the second book in this trilogy. It's a YA dark epic fantasy. So I've just flicked that off to the publisher, and hopefully I'll hear back something soon about whether they want it or not. But in the meantime, I'm about to release a, honestly, I'm not sure what it is. It's like a science fantasy space opera dystopian punk found family thing. It's a massive genre. And I honestly
visionary. Call it visionary, Nikki. Visionary.
Visionary is what I like that. I don't know what to call it, just visionary, that will do. And it was originally written for a T.S. Eliot From the Wasteland anthology submission, and it was going to be for that, but it ended up being about 10,000 words too long, so I had to write something else and then keep the story in the drawer for a little while. And I'm about to self-publish that in the next couple of months, so I'm waiting for my cover art to come through, which I'm very excited about. So that hopefully will be up before the end of the year.
Cool. But that's it for our show. Our theme music was by Matt May. Horror Nerds at Church releases every Thursday. Please comment, rate, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Support us on Patreon and get access to exclusive movie commentary episodes, BooTube episodes, and more bonus content, and a video recording of this very episode by going to patreon.com/horrornerdsatchurch. It's only $5 to sign up, cheaper than going to the carnival, I guess.
I was going to say, that carnival is way more expensive than $5.
Right? Follow us on social media, Facebook and Instagram at Horror Nerds at Church, and Twitter at HNACPOD for all the latest updates about upcoming films, news, and other announcements.
Until and next on time, Blue Sky at HNACPOD. Yes.
Thank you.
It just happened.
It just happened, yep. But until next time, support your local bookstores, support this anthology, go out, buy it, and support your libraries.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Bye. Awesome.